Thank you, Bill. Welcome. Last year at this occasion, Michael Cardozo asked me a question that I couldn't answer, and now that I've had a year, I want to try again. Michael's question concerned a young lady who he knew who had applied to the law school and received an offer of financial aid, although she came from a family that was well-to-do, and he wondered why there was any provision of financial aid given her family's assets. It's a good question, and it seems to me that it raises a broader question that you might be interested in hearing, and that is the role of admissions and the role of financial aid in how we finance the education of our students. Let's go back a few years. When I went to law school, and when many of the people in this room went to law school, financial aid at the University of Virginia was not a major part of the landscape. The truth is, all of us got a huge scholarship when we walked in the door in the form of low tuition. And that was true whether we were in-state or out-of-state, and it was true whether we were needy or wealthy. It simply was a uniformly provided subsidy by the taxpayers of Virginia. Well, in recent years, that subsidy has declined and now virtually disappeared. The subsidy has disappeared. And we are no longer in a situation where the University of Virginia has a great price advantage over competitors. So 5 years ago, when I became dean, it was clear that we needed to think again about how we went about admissions. Here's what we had done historically. We had Al Turnbull. Is Al here by any chance this morning? Sometimes he is. Many of us know Al Turnbull and have reason to be grateful to him. We had Al Turnbull, who made great judgments about individuals. As far as I'm concerned, never a mistake. And ran, I think, the best admissions office in the nation. But Al did not run an office of admissions and recruitment because recruitment simply wasn't necessary. People were recruited to come here by reputation and by the quality of the experience and, it must be said, by the price. And so when we admitted someone, we sent them a little letter saying, you're admitted, and they usually came, and that was the end of that. As our tuition rose, especially with financial self-sufficiency, we began to lose, as we have now totally lost, a financial advantage over competitor schools. And at about the same time, the atmosphere or the culture of legal education began to change in ways that I still don't fully understand, with major law schools actively recruiting students to attend. So when Susan Palmer replaced Al Turnbull, I said to her and said to you probably at that time that we needed to have now not merely a wonderful office of admissions, we needed to have an office of admissions and recruitment, or very possibly an office of recruitment and admissions because of the shift in culture. And a big part of that is scholarships. Now, the relationship of scholarship and need, which was what Michael Cardozo was asking about a year ago, is a little bit hard to describe fairly, and there's a reason for that. All students fill out forms provided by the federal government. Those forms allow colleges to assess family financial capacity, and they are the basis for scholarship awards based on need across America. Law students are all emancipated. They are all of an age where their family's assets technically do not count in these federal assessments. So that as a technical matter, all of our students have need, although we know perfectly well that some of their families have considerable assets. What actually happens with our students is that almost all of them finance their education largely through loans. 85 to 90% borrow the maximum amount of federally guaranteed loans. Most of them borrow much more than that. If you want to know the dollars we're talking about, tuition and fees to the university, I'm not talking about an apartment or a car or eating something. For non-residents next year, $35,000. For in-state students, $30,000. So you're talking about a $45,000, give or take a little bit, annual cost, and that mounts up. Most of our students borrow a lot to go to school and make an investment in themselves. And frankly, from where I sit, within limits, that makes some sense. Having a law degree from the University of Virginia is a huge capital asset. And it makes some sense for the people who acquire that capital asset to make some investment in it. So where does need fit in? Well, at some point, that indebtedness becomes really potentially crippling. When our average student has indebtedness of $65,000 plus from law school, and many have $100,000 or more, at some point, we need, on the basis of financial need, to be able to step in and provide some part of a grant as part of a larger financial aid package. Almost always a financial aid package that relies heavily on loans, but some part of a grant to keep that indebtedness within manageable bounds. And that's basically a need-based decision. But in many ways, need is addressed in the law school today at the back end, not the front end. Not with scholarships for students who are applying to law school, but with loan forgiveness for students who graduate from law school and who go into public service or other kinds of low-paying positions. And this seems to me the most targeted way to address financial need. Think of yourself as a young person who's graduating from law school with $100,000 in debt. If you go to one of the great firms in Washington or New York or San Francisco or Atlanta, that $100,000 debt burden is serious but manageable. The risk is that the debt burden will force you to go to a great law firm in a large city, when in fact what you really want to do is devote yourself to some kind of public service, to a charitable activity, to being a local prosecutor, to working as a public defender, to doing something for a small unit of government or the private sector that can't afford high prices for lawyers. And our loan forgiveness program is directly targeted to need when it matters. It's targeted to making sure our graduates who are dedicated to public service and willing to accept the financial sacrifice that goes with it, to making sure that they are able to make that choice and are not coerced into a different career path by the need to repay loans. So what is the remaining role for financial aid apart from need? Well, our competitor law schools are aggressive in trying to recruit the best students. And that requires that we respond to those efforts with financial aid offers, done basically not on the basis of need, but on the basis of merit. We do not try to buy students. We do not try to give students a financial reason to come to Virginia. We think the reason to come to Virginia is the quality of the institution and the quality of the student experience. But we do try to create, to the extent that our resources allow, we do try to create a level playing field financially, so that a student deciding to come to Virginia or Columbia, deciding between Virginia and Chicago, choosing between Virginia and NYU, that student is more or less indifferent financially to the choice and able to pick the institution with which he or she wishes to affiliate. And that requires a serious commitment of financial aid, because most of the institutions with which we compete have longer histories of high tuition, longer histories of raising money for scholarships, and therefore longer investments in endowments that produce financial aid. So basically what we're doing today is trying to play catch up, and our goal is to be able to say to the admissions department, I don't think we're quite there yet, but our goal is to be able to say to the admissions department, not go out and find students who have terrific numbers and recruit them by giving them a lot of money. Not at all that. But admit the very best students you can, and if they want to come to Virginia, try to remove the financial penalty they might face relative to other schools with greater resources. That's been our goal. I think we have been so far successful. Let me give you median LSATs. Now, I'm always embarrassed a bit to use that number. because using it sort of implies that this is a numerical decision and it's made simply on a numerical basis, and that's not true. It is not true descriptively, and it certainly should not be true normatively. Neither you nor I want a law school that admits numbers. We want a law school that admits human beings, individuals. But the median LSAT is a number that even I can remember, and so it provides a little sort of barometer of what we're doing here. And for 6 years, our median LSAT was 166. That's a good number. It's about the 93rd percentile of those who take the LSAT. And it remained constant for a long time. While it remained constant, in fact, we felt like we might be slipping a bit because the number of spaces in elite law schools remained steady. The number of applicants for elite law schools rose. The number of applicants with good numbers rose. And most of our competitors crept up a little bit while we remained basically flat. Why? Because we were, during that time, losing our tuition advantage. We have now moved from 166 as a median LSAT to 169. And that may not sound like a big jump, but it actually is fairly significant. In terms of percentiles, it moves from about the 94th percentile, 93rd, 94th, to just under the 98th percentile of all those who take the LSAT. Our student quality is second to a couple of law schools in the country judged on a quantitative basis and right in the sweet spot of the top tier. Now, I'm pleased with that outcome, and I'm pleased with how smart they are. I'm pleased with our success, and thanks to your generosity and being able to deploy financial aid to make it easier for students to come here. But it would be a pretty hollow sense of accomplishment. It would be, if truth be told, a disappointment. If we recruited classes of kids who were incredibly smart in some narrowly academic sense, but not full, rounded, balanced participants in our community. And the great news I have to deliver is that that is not at all true. On the contrary, the students enrolled at Virginia today, first of all, their culture would be instantly recognizable to you. If you were able to come back and immerse yourselves in the lives of our students, you would feel so clearly a part of a culture that you remember. It is still true that Virginia students maintain a remarkable sense of balance between work and play. It is still true that they are consistently, across the board, civil, cordial, supportive, nice to each other. And nice across all of the grounds that might divide us, differences of political affiliation, differences of ideology, differences of race and ethnicity, differences of ambition, people who want to go work as investment bankers and people who want to work only for nonprofits. And across all of those grounds of division, there is a cohesion in that student body that I think all of you would remember and enjoy and admire. But even as our students have become ever more selective academically, they've also become incredibly active in non-academic ways, or I should say, extracurricular ways. The most dramatic impression I have of the change in the law school in the last 10 years is the aggregate level of student activity. When I went to school, and most of you went to school, there were two student journals, Law Review and Vigil. Now there are nine. I can't say that the dean greets every new journal with enthusiasm. Sometimes you want to say, well, look, can you find something in there that sort of interests you? But the most recent journal was a law and business journal, and the kids who came to me wanted to do that had a mock first issue. They had a complete business plan about what they were going to do and how they were going to solicit excellent articles, and they had everything worked out, and all you could say to them was, God bless. Go right ahead. Spend some more of our money. So there are nine academic journals, and those nine academic journals are all active in a variety of ways, and they have events, they have symposia, they have conferences. I went this year to the conference of the 25th anniversary of the Virginia Journal of Environmental Law. It was a terrific event. People from all over the country organized in all kinds of interesting panels, a lot of discussion, for example, on watershed management, Chesapeake Bay being a premier example. We have some expertise in that question on our faculty, and the students brought in others. That's a discussion many of you would have been interested to hear. 25th anniversary of Virginia Journal of Environmental Law. The Law Review and the Student Legal Forum collaborate every year on a lecture by a prominent judge. There is a constant stream, and especially in the spring semester, of debates, of lectures, of workshops, of presentations, of extracurricular activities of educational value. Extracurricular activities of real educational value, and they are entirely the product of our students. To my mind, the most impressive of these events, but really just one out of literally 100 or so, is the annual Public Service and the Law Conference. It's been going on for only 7 years. Lasts for 3 days. They had, I counted them, 47 guest speakers in town for the conference. Typically, they were dealing in panels of three or four. They would have a panel of three people or four people, all of whom had some angle of vision on the problem, talking about how to organize a response to natural disasters such as Katrina. They had another panel on Katrina, which was entirely focused on the racial and class-based consequences of natural disasters and whether the harm that they caused affected some communities more severely than others. And these were spectacularly interesting and informative events. Just two comments about the annual conference on public service and the law. First, typical of Virginia, and I like this a lot, it's a big tent event. Every one of those panels has some disagreement on it. It's not a collection of the choir brought together to lament a particular problem or to press for the same solution. It is, on the contrary, a group of people chosen from a wide variety of perspectives. So, for example, in the Katrina panel I saw, they had a representative of the administration as well as some people who were critical. Critical of the administration in the same sense that Will Chamberlain is tall. And I love the fact that the Virginia tradition is to have an event which reflects commitment and engagement and passion and desire to improve the country, but also the reminder that you should seek several points of view, that you should have some balance in that group. I think that's just centrally part of who we are and who our institution should be. And that tradition is alive and well. And the second thing I say about the Center for the National Conference on Public Service and the Law, the headline speaker this year was Ted Kennedy, is that it is conceived, organized, implemented, led completely by students. This is not something that the dean of the law school assigns a staff to undertake to do. And it would be less impressive and less admirable if that were true. On the contrary, it's something the students do themselves, and that's the culture that our students have created. Even the kids who play softball, not, in the views of my colleagues at least, the very creme de la creme, but even the kids who spend their time playing softball. This year they organized the International Softball Tournament, and at the end of it they devoted more than $20,000 to local charities, including summer grants for public interest for law students, including a charity locally that deals with abused women and children. What's not to like? What's not to like about kids who could organize a softball tournament and somehow generate money? I called them in to ask, well, how did you do this? And the answer is they figured out that if they went to law firms, they could sell parts of their softball tournament. The Hogan and Hartson, I'm just picking a firm, the Hogan and Hartson home run contest. Because there are students there from 15 schools, and it's a kind of advertising. It wouldn't have occurred to me. I've asked them to apply for jobs at the Law School Foundation. So what we are seeing in our student body is a group of people of ever more refined and highly elite academic qualifications who are absolutely committed to the traditions of personal balance and decent behavior that you remember, and who have raised the level of activity, the level of commitment, the level of public service, raise the number of pro bono hours, raise the number of public service activities and projects and commitments funded, staffed, implemented by law students, raise all of those indicia of engagement and involvement to heights far beyond what have historically been true. It's a wonderful thing to see and a wonderful thing to be part of. And you've heard a couple of times already, let me repeat it to you. At the end of the third year, near the end of the third year, I send a letter to all the third year kids and I tell them about money. It's a very unvarnished letter. It simply talks about how much it costs to educate them in this institution and where that money comes from. And the message is, a lot of it comes from you. A lot of the money that pays for their education is a gift from you and others like you. And the income from the endowment given by you and others like you that support roughly a third of the cost of running this institution. So that even a student who pays out-of-state tuition isn't beginning to cover the true cost of education. Every student in the law school gets a subsidy from our graduates. We carry that message to them. We try to make them understand how much they owe you, and we ask them to respond by pledging their financial support to the law school. This year, the third year class, this is an effort organized by the students, and they have a very effective team. They all spread out. Each kid gets five or six others to contact, and they spread out and cover the class. This year, 92% of our third year students have pledged financial support to the law school. That is a drop-dead astonishing number. No other law school in America could hold a candle to that number. And it reflects a couple of things. It reflects first and foremost the quality of the student experience here, which is wonderful. And it reflects secondly the caliber of these individuals who, having had a wonderful education and a wonderful experience, aren't walking away from it saying, "Didn't I make out well?" but are joining hands with you in pledging their future support. The law school is doing pretty well today. We have our problems. We try to work with them year in and year out. But in the long term, I cannot imagine a better barometer of our future health. I can't imagine a better signal for where we will be 5 and 10 and 20 years from now than the response that these current graduates give to the example of your generosity. So thank you for coming. Hope you have a great time.